Hello, and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Zachary Probert, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
And we had some really good feedback from the kids. 76% of those kids really enjoy telling about their day to their parents in person.
With a social media ban for children just around the corner, a new research reveals children prefer face-to-face connection. We have all the details. Also, why vehicle-to-grid technology was one of the main focal points at a conference in Queensland. And later today...
Most of the cohort that I work with, people with intellectual disability, tend to go onto the NDIS and get ongoing support throughout their lives. Not everybody, but we'll say maybe a majority.
An organisation is helping Australians with an intellectual disability when their parents or carers pass away. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today... Pacific leaders are calling for drastic environmental change from Anthony Albanese and to honour their COP31 promises at the Pacific Islands Forum in the Solomon Islands. This comes while a decision regarding the Northwest Shelf Gas Project extension is still underway. I spoke to Head of Pacific at Greenpeace Australia Pacific, Shiva Goundon, to discuss the issue.
Pacific Islands for a long time have been calling on Australia to really address their emissions, you know, so addressing the fossil fuel carbon footprint in that sense, meaning closing the current projects that are in operation, not having any more new fossil fuel projects and addressing the fossil fuel exports. Because for the Pacific Islands, the emissions allow the global temperatures to within 1.5 degrees Celsius. And for the Pacific Island countries and Pacific Island communities, that 1.5 degrees is not just a number, it's our survival line.
What kind of environmental impacts can happen to the Pacific Island if Australia does not commit to its climate actions?
Pacific Islands have recently, in the last decade or so, have had... extremely intense climate impacts that have really put Pacific into a frame of existential crisis. You know, so we've got sea level rise that consumes our land, and it's extremely important for the Pacific Islanders, the concept of land and our connection to land. And if you have sea that completely wipes it out, it stops people from living on that land and having to move, so being displaced. And that means taking away all the cultural connections and the memories you have to that land. The other thing is this intensity and the regularity of like category 4 and 5 cyclones. Vanuatu 2 years ago had 2 cyclones within 2 days, which was category 4 and 5. This means always rebuilding, picking up pieces, having to stay resilient, etc. Then you have climate impacts that actually take away a lot of things that you value. And that means the cultural components. You've got family members who pass away during this climate events. You've got crops, etc., that gets destroyed. And in countries like Tuvalu and Kiribati, which are atoll nations, you can't even grow the traditional crops that you are used to eating because the sea level rise has salinated the land. So there's so many things that impacts the Pacific. And if Australia doesn't address its emissions and doesn't address its carbon footprint, it will ensure that it's driving the Pacific even further towards expanding this existential crisis.
One of the things that was addressed was the Northwest Shelf Gas Project. If Prime Minister Albanese and the courts do go ahead with the extension, what can this look like for relations between Australia and the Pacific Islands?
Yeah, if Prime Minister Albanese does give this green light for the Northwest Shelf Fossil Fuel Project expansion, which, by the way, is the most polluting fossil fuel project in Australia, then it truly is an attack on Pacific right to exist. And Pacific values. You know, he has lately been using this line that addressing climate change is, I think he said, entry fee for credibility within this region. And neither science nor common sense would point to expanding or starting new fossil fuel projects, you know, in addressing climate change genuinely. And he doesn't just have a responsibility to the Pacific region. He has a responsibility to the Australian people. He has a responsibility globally, because this is the 10th year now from the Paris Agreement, which Australia ratified. And in the Paris Agreement, it clearly states that you have to keep global temperatures below 1.5 degrees, which, like I said previously, is a survival line for the Pacific. And that doesn't include new fossil fuel projects. It means shutting down the current ones as soon as possible and addressing those fossil fuel exports, because this project is going to go beyond 2060 and 2070, which is not what the Pacific needs right now. He has been engaged in a lot of important bilateral decisions with the Pacific countries, but no amount of side deals, you know, no amount of checkbook diplomacy can mask Australia's climate record. He has to stick by this principle and the word that he keeps using of vuvale in the Pacific. And vuvale means family, and family doesn't sign away lives of family members towards further existential crisis.
What actions towards non-renewable energy is needed for this?
I think it needs to be a holistic kind of addressing of this whole issue of climate injustice that has been happening in the Pacific, and many also due to Australia's actions. You cannot just transition away from fossil fuels without ensuring there is finance that allows for the transition, ensures that there is technical capacity that allows for the transition, etc. Because remember, the Pacific region contributes the least to the climate crisis. They didn't cause the climate crisis. So the actions of Australia has to be holistic in this nature. And this narrative of gas being a transition fuel, and it's not backed by science. You know, this is industry driven. This is fossil fuel mafia driven. Renewable energy is the answer. And our region has enough ability to generate the necessary clean energy that's needed from solar and wind. And most of the gas and coal that Australia does produce, it's used for exports, you know, for Japan and South Korea. So what Australia needs to do is start addressing this whole element holistically for the Pacific, which means transitioning away from fossil fuel and its own economy, addressing the exports, but also ensuring there's the necessary finance and technical capacity within the region to be able to just transition into renewable energy.
That was Head of Pacific at Greenpeace Australia Pacific, Shiva Goundon.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
The social media ban for Australians under the age of 16 will take effect in December this year. But a new survey says children prefer quality family time over screens. During Child Protection Week this week, a new national survey by Act for Kids found 41% of children aged 10 to 16 prefer face-to-face connection with their families. The study also revealed 3 in 4 kids feel most connected when speaking in person about their day. The Wire's Yan Wang spoke with Act for Kids Executive Director Thomas McIntyre about how the Let's Connect IRL In Real Life campaign aims to help families strengthen real-life connections.
Act for Kids, as part of our Child Protection Week campaign, we commissioned some research from 300 children aged 10 to 16 about how they like to engage with their family digitally and face-to-face. And we had some really good feedback from the kids, directly from the kids, that 76% of those kids really enjoy hearing or telling about their day to their parents in person. And it really tells the story that kids do enjoy that one-to-one interaction with their parents and close adults.
One of the campaign's message is about encouraging adults to be physically present when children are using devices. So what do you think, why is this so important for children's well-being?
75% of kids actually said that they are very happy for their parents to be present when they're using their devices and online. And 17% actually said that they felt safer when their parents were nearby. Unfortunately, what we know is only about 10% of children have a close adult with them when they're online. So kids don't mind their close adults being there when they're online, and we know it's a safety, really important safety message to families to be aware of the online activity of their kids, to know what sites they're going to, and to be available to them to help them if they need to ask questions or they've seen something online that concerns them or worries them.
So the Let's Connect IRL campaign is launching during Child Protection Week. Could you please explain how this campaign aims to help kids feel more supported in such a digitally fast-paced world?
Absolutely. So it's incorporating that digital world with the, you know, the real-time face-to-face interactions, and the kids are telling us that they really enjoy those interactions. So some of the messages are, you know, make use of those incidental moments when driving home from school, asking the kids with open questions, you know, what was your favourite part of today? What wasn't so good about today? Trying not to use closed questions, so using questions that the kids can answer. But also, you know, really getting involved in their digital world. We can't ignore the fact that kids, you know, live in that digital environment as well. So parents can play games with their kids. They can actually join in that digital gaming environment. They can get online and do searches with their kids, look at TikTok videos, use it as a conversation point. You know, we can use those videos as a chance to discuss what they've seen, how they felt about it, and parents can put a close adults can help them process what they're seeing online. So it's just finding that balance between having good quality face-to-face time, but also acknowledging that we can also be part of their digital world as well.
And for parents who want to build strong real-life connection with their children, what advice would you give them?
Oh, you know, find something that the kids love doing, that you both love doing together. It could be, you know, throwing a footy around. It could be listening to music. It's finding those incidental moments and those things that the kids like doing and enjoy doing with parents. It doesn't have to be for hours, or it can be just 10 minutes of quality time. It can make a real difference and gives the kids a chance to engage with their close adults and parents.
If Australians want to learn more about the campaign or access resources, where can they go?
We'd certainly encourage people to go to our website at actforkids.com.au. There's some great resources there and tools for kids and parents to use, and links to some really important sites that give advice on how to do that face-to-face interaction and how to be safe online as well.
That was Thomas McIntyre from Act for Kids speaking with The Wire's Yan Wang. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Zachary Probert in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, to our listeners in Armidale on Tune FM, and to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. Vehicle to grid is where electric vehicles draw power from the electricity grid to power their batteries as well as households, and it's one of the main focal points discussed at the Smart Energy Queensland Expo this week by industrial leaders. Over the years, there's been much discourse surrounding their technology. So where are we currently at in Australia in terms of shifting into this new way of powering vehicles? To find out the answer for this question and more, The Wire's Tony Pankaluik attended the expo and spoke to Smart Transport and E-Mobility Lead from the Smart Energy Council, Alan Edwards.
Vehicle to grid is exactly what it sounds like, or vehicle to grid, vehicle to home, V2 plus we're now calling it, because obviously there are applications that are there. But basically it's an electric vehicle that has a battery that is then able to be plugged into your home or into the grid, particularly to be able to supply power from your battery back into the grid system. And then vehicle to home, of course, is being able to plug that back in through your inverters, etc., and power your home. And V2 plus, you know, could be obviously powering other things that are out there, but using the power from the battery in your your car to be able to support the grid, technically, is what vehicle to grid is.
So whereabouts are we at in Australia?
The technology's there now for us to do vehicle to grid and for us to be able to do that quite successfully. You know, other countries around the world, particularly the Norwegian countries, etc., are a lot further down the electrification road, particularly of vehicles than we are. And it's very much a part of their system there. Here in Australia, though, we have the longest grid in the world and some unique things about the Australian environment, which other countries don't, of course. Obviously, being such a big landmass, a small population, all of these type of things that go out with that. But probably the main factors for Australia and the Australian market really turning over to vehicle grid at the moment is the bi-directional chargers. Currently, at the moment, there are only several of those which are registered on the Clean Energy Council list for us to be able to use that have had their standards checked and those things. But probably one of the other major areas is the actual vehicle manufacturers at the moment. Whilst their vehicles are very capable of vehicle to grid, they actually haven't put it into their warranty systems that they will warrant their vehicle should you use it for vehicle to grid applications at the moment. Most of the vehicles that are out there really only require a software change to be able to make that a reality for their cars. But there are in Australia several vehicles that do that. The Mitsubishi Outlander, which is a hybrid vehicle, is warranted for those things. The Ford Lightning that has been converted here in Australia by OzEV, that's obviously vehicle to grid capable. And also all of the Nissan Leafs, which have been probably one of the oldest vehicles out there electric-wise. But I would expect, say, year to 3 years that most manufacturers will be bringing that on. It's largely just consumer demand is going to be driving more and more of that. And as we also have heard from the Ford Lightning people, that it really has no effect on the battery. So it's not like you're using more of your battery if you're plugging it into your house or not. They're currently probably the slowdown points just at this point in time.
So could you tell us a bit about what you and the Smart Energy Council are doing? If you could talk a little bit about your work.
So the Smart Energy Council, as you know, are a non-for-profit industry body. But what we do is support industry, really, and obviously the Australian transition to renewable energy and that push forward. So some of the work that I'm particularly doing in the smart transport and e-mobility space is getting around and trying to put together all of the handshakes between all of the different people that are required across this whole electrification of the vehicle sector there. So that can include grids, it can include obviously our power connectors in relation to that, but also the technology in relation to bi-directional chargers and, you know, home technology that goes in and around there. So some of that's not only connecting those people together, but getting all those people to work together so that we can iron out all the lumps and bumps there, and quite a lot of policy work too, to be fair. We work a lot with governments and provide a lot of industry feedback to governments and government sectors there and advise obviously on policy that's also going to be helped to bring these things forward and develop them further into the adoption, which just has to happen for the electrification of Australia.
Is there any other talking points that I haven't mentioned that you'd like to talk about just as we wrap up?
I really encourage where I can that, you know, the adoption first of EVs and taking that up on a personal level for people here. I think that most people are starting to see now that we've got in all of these new types of cars come to Australia, which is amazing. But also some of the things that have been brought up is that for a change, you know, if you start thinking about these things, our vehicle and the energy we use to drive our vehicles can actually be a bit of a profit center for us as consumers. I've never been able to fill my car with petrol and then go and sell my petrol back to somebody else later. Or, you know, even driving my EV, like I came down the mountain the other day and I left there with 493 kilometres coming into town. I'd already done 50 kilometres and I had over 500 kilometres in my tank there just because of regenerative braking and things like that. So I found that quite exciting that I can actually drive this and have more energy in it than what I did when I left because of these type of things. But I think as Australians start to electrify and any fears that they may have in relation to just that change will probably be allayed very quickly. And most people that you've spoken to that have already made the switch to EVs and that over are certainly in no hurry to go back. But I think that more and more so as that comes through, transport's, you know, a vital thing for Australians, again, because of our population and the size of our country. It's sort of one of those things that we all have cars running out. And I think that that switch over largely will be driven, particularly because of the cost savings and also those runovers. But, you know, obviously all the savings on fuel as well during that time. So if I can encourage people, you know, start with a car, really have a good look at it. And at the moment, it's probably cheaper to buy those now, let alone the running costs.
That was Alan Edwards from the Smart Energy Council speaking to The Wire's Tony Pankaluik. When someone we love passes away, we are left with grief and sadness. However, when Australians with disabilities lose their main carers or supporters, life becomes much more challenging. and sometimes it becomes hard to find services and guidance. An organisation is providing guidance and support to Australians with an intellectual disability who are in this journey. Powered Media's Emma Myers spoke with advocacy leader at Valid, Anthony Rizzoli, about the services available for adults with intellectual disabilities.
The first thing we did a few years ago is develop some easy read information around topics like what is grief, what is palliative care, and what is dying, and how does it look like, and things like that. So we developed these resources. It was co-designed by people with intellectual disabilities, and a group of them end up taking these resources and visiting people who live in disability group homes to talk about these issues. Part of the project was to do some training for staff to support people who work in disability group homes around the best supports they could give the people they work with around things like dying and getting counselling and things like that. And we're hoping that in the future we can go out to other people, not just staff and some people with disabilities that live in group home, but maybe supporting other people with intellectual disabilities, maybe if they live family or live on their own and things like that.
So what happens to adult children with intellectual disabilities after their support system goes away?
Most of the cohort that I work with, people with intellectual disability, they tend to go onto the NDIS and get ongoing support throughout their lives. Not everybody, but we'll say maybe a majority. And then within those supports, hopefully they get the right supports and it keeps going to the rest of their lives because they have an ongoing permanent disability. And in those supports, when the person has a change of life or change of circumstances, as they say in the NDIS, they look for the funding to support them. When it comes around things like death and dying and so on, it's important to continue that work where people are constantly being informed about what services are out there to support them when they're in this situation and if they need it. And one of the ways we try to work with that is to have an information in a way that people can understand. So we target it that way.
What about the emotional side? How do you explain to them that this is the situation that they're facing?
We've got information to support people to understand things like emotions. What is grief? What are some of the physical signs? What are some of the emotional signs? It's important to talk to someone you trust about it. So the whole idea is to speak up about your feelings. And I know for a lot of people that we work with that they may not have verbal communication, but it's important that the supporters also know about those signs and those physical things that people might go through, those emotional things. Sometimes it's trauma, of course, and have a good network of people around them to support them when they're going through something like that.
So what happens in the interim period?
We target our programs to support people to know about death, dying and grief and so on was through support workers and people who live in disability group homes and support workers giving the support. And a lot of service providers out there are really interested in supporting people around their grief and stuff like that. It's important to let family know that one day they won't be around. We do that in other programs too. Currently we're doing something like My Home, My Plan, where we're talking to people about what supports they need and future living options, just in case one day that they're not living with their family. We talk about things like what emotional supports you might need, what equipment and so on. So it's an ongoing conversation. It's more work to be done. There are examples where things don't quite work out and we need to target some family members too, because there are examples of where family members don't want to bring up issues of dying and grief. It's an area that sometimes they don't want to go there. A lot of families do, but some families don't. One particular person that I interviewed spoke about wanting to see her sister and thought her sister was not talking to her. And this is going for a couple of months. And then when I want to inquire about this and say to house supervisor at the time, what's going on here? This person wants to connect to the sister. The house supervisor mentioned that her sister had passed away and none of the family wanted to bring it up. What's worse, knowing that your sister doesn't want to talk to you or knowing that her sister had passed away and then going through all the grieving process, and of course her rights to know about her sister is really important too. There's a lot of work around that as well, approaching the subject of when a family member or other are grieving, say are dying and stuff like that, and the importance of talking to people with intellectual disability and knowing what it is and how to deal with it. I think it's a difficult one for a lot of people who communicate verbally to express things like grief and understanding of dying and stuff like that. We do our best to explain it. Sometimes people do have family religious or faith beliefs about dying and going to heaven and things like that. And it's important to respect what they bring and what they think and how their faith and stuff like that. But it's important to talk about what actually happens when you're dying. So we do have information on what happens to your body, and we talk about the circle of life, and in it also things like, you know, the importance of having a funeral, being part of the funeral.
That was Anthony Rizzoli from Valid, speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. And if you would like to listen to any of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yagara countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Zachary Probert. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.